I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, a conversation about sexual assault on college campuses. Statistically, members of fraternities are 3 times more likely to rape than males in the general population. And women in sororities are 74% more likely to be victims of sexual assault than their non-sorority counterparts. 1 in 5 women will be sexually assaulted while in college. But many of these women will choose not to report those assaults. Why is that? What can colleges and universities do to make campuses safer and to see that perpetrators of assault are punished accordingly? Dr. Sherry Parks of the Maryland Institute College of Art joins me for this month's installment of Midday Culture Connections right after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Today, another edition of Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks of the Maryland Institute College of Art. When Dr. Christine Blasey Ford and Judge Brett Kavanaugh testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee last week, not only was it another pivot point in the Me Too movement, it also afforded a window into a culture of drinking and bad conduct among privileged young people in the 1980s. Was that culture of privilege and excess substantially different from the 1970s and the 1960s? Did the culture change in the next millennium at elite private high schools and the nation's most exclusive colleges and universities? So today, a conversation about sexual assault in general and perhaps particularly on campuses. Given that so many assaults are not reported to campus police or local law enforcement, do we even have a handle on the scope of the problem and what we might do to alleviate it? Are students aware of their rights under what's known as Title IX? Are schools doing everything they can to educate and inform students about assault and harassment? What did high school students, I wonder, at the kind of schools attended by Christine Blasey and Brett Kavanaugh, I wonder what they made of the hearings last week? Dr. Sherry Parks is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. She's a regular contributor to our program, joining us on the first Tuesday of the month for Midday Culture Connections. Good to see you, ma'am.
Hi there.
If you would like to be part of our conversation, listeners, we welcome that. 410-662-8780. That's our phone number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. So, Sherry, you know, I happen to have breakfast with a friend of mine this morning, Lisa Welchman, and I'm not sure how this came up, but we were both remembering an Emily Dickinson poem that we both liked. I felt a funeral in my brain, and mourners to and fro kept treading till it seemed that sense was breaking through. And I think last week it felt like a funeral in my brain watching that extraordinary hearing unfold with Dr. Blasey Ford in the morning and then Judge Kavanaugh in the afternoon. I just wonder, as a cultural moment, everybody sensed that it was very significant. So there was historic. There was this notion that something really serious was going on. Something quite extraordinary was going on. As a person who knows an awful lot about culture historically, I mean, what was your reaction to that?
Well, first, and I know I'm not supposed to do this, but in your funeral, what died?
In my funeral?
Not your own, but the one in your brain. What died?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the funeral in my brain just, I think, to me, indicated this enormous sense of sadness that we had gotten to this point in the political process, and then the process to confirm a nominee to the Supreme Court, and we're talking about beer and blackouts, and it was just better to talk about it than not talk about it, to be sure, because if it's a if it's a real thing and if it's a thing that's an important dimension to this argument about whether this gentleman should be approved for the court, it certainly needs to be aired. But it just seemed, perhaps on a basic level, it's the loss of innocence, or perhaps. I mean that might just be really incredibly naive. But also just the degradation of the process, the degradation of the conversation. We're no longer talking about judicial philosophy or competence as a lawyer or as a judge. We're just talking about just brutish, hideous behavior. I don't know. It just seemed like a sad moment to me, in addition to historic.
And that's really interesting, because for me, and I think a lot of people, maybe many of them who are women, it was a breakthrough moment, a tipping point, that there has been this high-mindedness that, I mean, has its purpose historically and politically, and many of us wish we could get back to that moment. But underneath, there's been this brutishness that wasn't rising to the surface. And so now, I mean, we've been witnessing a breaking through of all kinds of silences in this case, the cone of silence that surrounds places of privilege. Colleges are places of privilege, but societal places of privilege where there was all kinds of brutality going on. But it was never, and you've heard people actually say this, it shouldn't ruin a man's life, his career. He's so important that his brutishness when he was a younger man shouldn't change that. And there's been this public recognition of something that lots of other people knew but didn't talk about, is that there has been all of this horrible behavior going on. But and certainly when I tried to report something that had happened to a student at another institution years and years ago, I was told that you don't ruin a good man's career that way. So I took another channel.
Yeah.
But that idea of maintaining male privilege mostly, and there's in a couple of ways there's a racial dimension to it. So I'm going to use the cliche of white male privilege here, of that it overrode any other behavior, even their current behavior, that it didn't rise to the surface. And now, I mean, this has been a couple of years in this process. We now know that all kinds of terrible things happen, and that it wasn't reaching a certain sphere of power in terms of what people talked about.
How is it different from Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas, which was another funeral in my brain?
Well, you know, I think it is different in parts. I think we're going to talk about the history between that probably. But here there's been this deluge of women, other women coming forward. With Anita Hill, there was a little, and certainly there were some voices, but the floodgates have opened. And because this behavior has been going on for so long and so prevalent, it's not stopping. I heard a male public speaker recently say, enough, enough. But of course, it's still going on. It's not like suddenly all of this behavior stopped and we can get over it and go past it. There's a similar argument for slavery. But here, it's still the whole stuff is still going on. And so it's every day there are tens of thousands. I mean, there's a new statement when Trump tweeted that, why didn't she go, or her parents, our loving parents, go to the police? Suddenly you had the tens of thousands of women that day tweeting, why I didn't report. So every turn, there's a new part of the story, because there's so many women out there, and not all women, but predominantly women, who have been victimized, and now they can speak.
And the latching together of this behavior and these elite schools, either the elite prep school before Mr. Kavanaugh attended Yale University, but even at Yale University, there's another bunch of allegations about behavior that was equally brutish or worse even while he was in college. There was one from 1998 that's being looked into, which is well after he's in college. And again, these allegations are just that at the moment, and people are, you know, the FBI is putatively looking into them. But the connection between this privileged educational environment and sexual assault. You've been an academe for your whole career.
Yeah, my whole career.
You live the life in this milieu.
Well, let's. We also need to say that people of all economic strata experience this behavior. And there's some differences, but the difference is that in the more elite spaces, there's almost no surveillance of this behavior. I mean, compare this to a working class Black kid in Baltimore of the same age. In a academic institution, there's this cone. I used to try to convince my this is a slightly different example, but that when they were sexual women, that when they were sexual, they should make sure that there were protection. And they would say, but they're college students. And I would say, you know, we don't filter for that at admissions. But there's this idea that it's just us kids and everything is safe and it's like Las Vegas. I mean, actually, Brett Kavanaugh said what goes on at Georgetown Prep stays at Georgetown Prep. And then there's this four-year period where you can do anything you want. This is a national phenomenon. Do anything you want, and then you graduate, and then you have to be grown up. And so that, plus the idea that, and this is starting to change, that many colleges and universities handle their own crime. So they don't have reciprocity. Or sometimes, particularly in the 80s.
They handle it in-house. They don't go to local law enforcement.
Right. And particularly in the 1980s, you didn't report it off campus. Now, think about it. For the last week or so, there have been lots and lots of conversations about, you know, drunken parties, and congressmen and senators have been saying, well, you know, God forbid you knew what I did in college. Well, think about it. You're talking about a population where 3/4 of them are underage. And while the 80s were a period where, you know, sometimes you could drink between 18 and 21, for the large part you're talking about, in one scenario, when he threw ice, there's a suggestion that it wasn't beer. Well, you know, even in the 80s, that was probably problematic. And so that idea that you can do things like publicly drinking outside underage near or on a college campus, but you can't 2 miles away, sets up that circle of privilege that's there. And you don't have to be terribly elite for that to happen.
It is fascinating that on the one hand, as you say, people are saying this man does not deserve to have his life ruined and his reputation, you know, permanently sullied. Almost disconnected to whether or not he did this brutish behavior mm-hmm. that he is accused of. And the other is, if he did it, he was 17 or he was 19 or he was 20 or so. He was a young boy. As you say, he's got this, you know, this 4-year window where you're allowed to be a complete jerk, and then afterwards you have to be grown up. Those arguments really have taken hold. I mean, there's a lot of people gripping to those arguments now ferociously.
Well, and what's been interesting is, I mean, you know, there is the ferocity, but there's also this interesting bewilderment. Why are we talking about this? I mean, he's a good man. He's an important man. Why are we even bringing this up? And the message to victims or people who are would-be victims, because particularly if you're a woman, even if you haven't been assaulted, you act in ways that are defensive. You take self-defense courses. You look under the car before you get in it. You do all these things that anticipate or protect from. So it infects the psyche of almost anybody who sees themselves as vulnerable. So this is not a victimless, you know, time. It is at someone's expense. And the part of the hearing that really got to me is when, I mean, I love that she was an academic woman. There's another part of academia that's at place here, both Anita Hill and Dr. Ford. When she explains cognition and, you know, the different parts of the brain. So I love that part. But then she's explaining that to say, when they said, why don't you remember everything? And she explains the effect of trauma on the brain, but the part that she remembers the most is them laughing. That's the part that I think gets everybody, that this is play for them. And maybe, and there's lots of evidence that would support that maybe he doesn't remember. I mean, I guess we're on public radio, we say if it happened, that he might not remember his face. There's a lot of data that would explain why he might not remember her face.
Let's take a phone call from Janice in Baltimore. Janice, welcome to Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Hi, everybody. Hey, Tom. I wanted to say that I really do believe that Kavanaugh had a blackout episode where he was still functioning, but he doesn't recall what he did, because I really definitely believe Dr. Ford. I know she would not come to Capitol Hill and raise her right hand and lie to the Senate and all of America if what happened to her is not true. And I think that my issue with Kavanaugh is that he will not own the fact that he was reckless when he was a youngster. I mean, and nobody is perfect. I'm not saying that he should be hung out to dry because he did some reckless things. But my issue with him is that why doesn't he just own what he did? Because to sit there and act as though, you know, he's just so perfect, is just, it really bothers me. And there was something in the report that came out yesterday about this brawl that he had in the bar. The policeman that interviewed him wrote in the report that when he was asked about the throwing of the ice or whatever it was that he did to the other guy in the bar, that he refused to answer. And I thought, where have we seen that? The same type of evasiveness that he showed in the hearings, he was doing it even back then when he was a youngster. So, see, people really don't change all that much unless they make a concerted effort to change. And I think that he didn't want to answer those questions about the drinking because he knows that it would inevitably lead to the fact that there's a door open for the possibility that he actually did commit this assault.
Yeah, well, thank you for those comments, Janice. Much appreciated.
Yeah, there's so much to unpack there, but I mean, there's an analogy with Facebook, with people trying to take down their Facebook so that people in their adult life don't see what they were doing in college. But notice the point I made about privilege before. If you are, again, go back to that working class black kid, if he refuses to answer, does anybody think he would have gotten away with refusing to answer in that circumstance? No. And so that level of protection is really important, and it gives people license to behave, as you said, badly.
Yeah, and it's interesting because had Mr. Kavanaugh's demeanor, his countenance, been different on Thursday, had he come in somewhat contrite, saying, I'm really sorry, I acted badly when I was a young person. I don't remember this incident, but I can certainly understand the pain Dr. Ford is going through. But this should be about judicial competence, and it should be about other things. And I apologize for any brutish behavior I did. I wonder if people would simply say, well, that's nice that you're apologizing. However, the brutish behavior indicates, as Janice says, you know, you don't really change that much from when you're 17 to 27 to 57.
I think that certainly would have taken the air out of for that moderate voter who is now shifting. But I also think it's really important to recognize how ruthless certain fields are. That exact same behavior is utilized in you know, law school and administrations and corporate America. They're the same rules.
Yeah. Got to take a break, but we will come back and have more of this conversation with Dr. Sherry Parks from the Maryland Institute College of Art. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. To catch me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. It's Midday. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, the Supreme Court has reconvened for a new session. And as the justices turn their attention to the docket, of course, the nation's attention remains on Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and the FBI investigation into the allegations of sexual assault that had been made against him. We'll review how the nomination process has played out so far and how the historic events of the past week will impact the future of the High Court. My guests tomorrow are Ian Samuel. He's a co-host of First Monday, a podcast about the Supreme Court. Cleta Mitchell. She's an attorney who specializes in political law. And Thiru Vignaraja, former federal prosecutor who clerked for Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, and of course, just recently ran for Baltimore State's attorney, was unsuccessful in that bid. But that's all coming up tomorrow. We're talking about the Supreme Court moving forward and looking ahead here on Midday. If you just joined us today, we are discussing sexual assault on college campuses and elsewhere. A startling 20 to 25% of college women are victims of forced sex while they are in school. Dr. Sherry Parks is with me today in Studio A. You are welcome to join our conversation at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Sherry, this notion of toxic masculinity, that term now is now just sort of part of the common parlance. I mean, and it really wasn't, I'd say, even 8 months ago, 10 months ago. I mean, maybe in academic circles it was.
Yeah,
but
it was.
It wasn't for, I think, most lay listeners and readers. What did we learn about toxic masculinity in the Kavanaugh hearings? I mean, do we have a different understanding of it now? Is our understanding of whatever people impute that term to mean evolving?
Well, I think, the cover on it has been blown. I mean, that type of behavior that in the last couple of years, the deaths from fraternities, from over-drinking has been exposed. What is now commonly known, but wasn't known if you weren't in Boston, Red Sox Nation, where the tickets are very, very expensive, really are, and there's actually been a dissertation done by a Maryland researcher on Red Sox Nation. These are white men who are taking their privilege into the ball field, and in interviews said, this allows us to act the way we acted in college. We can get just as, in the arena, we can get just as drunk and be just as loud and crazy as we did in college. So that idea of college as this oasis where you can behave anything has been blown open. I do need to say that the difference the statistics that you're citing, what has changed, and this is not at all to blame the women, but what has changed is binge drinking and again, this is a racialized statistic, by white women, which makes them more vulnerable. Part of the equalization of the sexes is that women could be as hard drinking as the men. And it is a really great idea, and I certainly support it. There are often downsides, and that binge drinking has really shot up. And I have to explain so people don't complain. When I mentioned race with binge drinking, while it is changing, it has been predominantly a white phenomenon, because if you're not safe, you don't binge drink. In fact, some colleges have recruited more people of color to lower their binge drinking statistics. It has that kind of effect on it.
Yeah.
And so alcohol plus, we have to admit that there are lots of other drugs. More college students are coming with medication, which is not unusual for them to go off of it, and then it becomes recreational. So there are all kinds of new behaviors that lead to this phenomenon.
It's interesting that most sexual assaults, the women who suffer from sexual assaults, who are assaulted, they are assaulted in their first semester or the first or second semester.
Yeah.
50% of assaults on college campuses happen in August, September, October, and November, at the beginning of the first semester. So that's what do we make of that?
Well, and I have to say that's a longstanding phenomenon. Before social media on college campuses, you could see people who weren't students cruising the campus. And most campuses then cut down on who can cruise around their campuses. But the idea that these are young women and men who are away from home for the first time, they haven't...
An assumption of naivete, perhaps.
The assumption of naivete and freedom that happens. And at the same time, people are trying to... The long adolescence is even longer. They're away from home. We know that they have been parented more heavily than previous generations, and so suddenly they're free. You know, when I was a freshman, we stayed up all night just because we could, and then realized it wasn't any more exciting. Add social media and expanding knowledge of sexualization. We did a show about a year ago on the pornographication of society. So you're talking about generations that have been raised not on situation comedies per se, but on pornography, and they act out their fantasies.
We have an email from Julie who says, working class and low income women who do not attend college experience assault at higher rates, but this issue does not receive the same attention as its campus counterpart. I think that's a fair point. Mm-hmm. She goes on to say, teaching about how to prevent and avoid sexual assault in college is putting out a fire temporarily while doing nothing to take the firewood, lighter fluid, and matches away from the students who've largely received no meaningful sex education and come to campus with a variety of perspectives and levels of experience around sexuality, drinking, and so on. Comprehensive sex education that starts at a young age can reduce sexual assault, but Maryland's current policies on sex ed, which are actually quite good, according to Julie, are not followed by most districts. So starting in college to try to fix this problem is far too late, and such efforts do nothing to avoid the more common experience of sexual assault among those who never attend college. Sharon, let's go to you in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Hi.
Hi.
I have found myself just getting furious as I listen to people with that argument that one stupid thing he did when he was 17 shouldn't, quote, ruin his life. In fact, this man has had a privileged life for decades. He has reached the very highest level of his profession. I'm a psychotherapist, and for the last 35 or 40 years, I've been working in trauma and with survivors of especially sexual trauma. And we're talking about people who suffer for decades because of this one reckless act, in quotations. And the idea that it's like it's only one half of the equation. If he wrecked the car because he was reckless, okay, if it didn't hurt someone else. But the idea that women can be targets, it's part of the rape culture that I think the woman who was talking about non-college women said in her email, we really have to look at the whole culture, because somehow there are people who still believe it's okay to think that a woman is a target.
And that's a good point, Sharon. I appreciate the call. You know, this notion that for men, sex, the act of sex is a conquest, mm-hmm. rather than a mutually agreed upon expression of affection. I mean, it's just it seems simple enough that, you know, but the conquest notion of sex, and a lot of this has to do with fraternities. I mean, we hear a lot on college campuses about fraternities. A lot of the bad behavior is laid at the door of these fraternities. I mean, the Guardian had in London had a piece about 4 years ago that said that boys in fraternities, young men in fraternities, were three times more likely to commit rape. That's a lot more likely than the general population, and that their sorority counterparts, 74% of women in sororities, 74% of them were more likely to be victims of sexual assault because they putatively put themselves in proximity of these fraternity guys.
Well, but that's not the fantasy they're hoping to lay out in most cases. But with fraternities and sororities, you have privilege within privilege. You're talking about, I mean, they're not free, so you're paying an additional fee to belong to the sorority and fraternity. You're paying even more of a fee if you're living in the house. And so there's a certain level of lack of surveillance that happens in sorority and fraternity houses. That's if you're in the dorm, there's a whole apparatus that tries to police your behavior. But if you can pay enough, you can end up in this situation. This isn't true of all sororities and fraternities, but almost every campus in the country has a couple that they wish they could get rid of. But yes, the statement about it permeating through culture, studies that ask older women, now, so this is a design flaw, but they ask older women about their first sexual experience. We have this image that it's somebody your own age and you have as much control as the other person. That's not what the data shows. Women talk about their first sexual experience being with somebody older and feeling in retrospect, now that's important, that they were not in control of the situation. So there, the continuum of coercion is long.
Let's go to the phones. Dave in Annapolis, thanks for calling. Welcome to Midday.
Hey, thanks. One quick comment. This is back on the presentation of Judge Kavanaugh. It's interesting to me that, you know, I would wager $10,000 that if you looked at the reason why he was crying at intervals throughout his testimony was that he regrets something that he did and can't change it. And the reason that Dr. Blasey Ford was crying was because she endured something she had no control over. You watch and see how that plays out. And all of this is within the context of looking at, you know, how we are as humans and what we ask of in our, you know, political appointees and our political process. It's interesting that people only seem to wake up when they realize that there's some catastrophic event like this that has occurred, instead of being mindful that who they vote for matters, the results of those things matter, and the fact that we've got somebody in that kind of position of power, whether it's on a college campus, a trustee of a board, that there should be no hint of impropriety at all, top to bottom, because when there is, and there's a problem like this, this is the result, and the whole system falls apart. That's all.
Well, thank you, Dave. I appreciate it. Of course, we should remind folks that Judge Kavanaugh strenuously rejects the allegations that he did anything untoward to Ms. Blasey Ford or, as he says, anybody else.
Well, culturally, I mean, I know moms of adolescent boys who are using this as a teaching moment. We also need to, when I began being a college teacher, I thought they were adults. And when I learned more about their cognitive development, when we're talking about college students, we're talking about people whose the part of the brain that understands consequences is not completely done yet. And so they do things without knowing the consequences. And control is, at on both sides, as he points out, is at the bottom of this.
You know, UMBC here in Catonsville, the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, has been the subject of protests and emotional meetings with the administration there. Dr. Freeman Hrabowski is the president there, longstanding president. And in the last couple of weeks, they've had protests and meetings. There's even been a lawsuit that has been filed claiming that claims of sexual assault were not taken seriously and not prosecuted to the full extent. I had a conversation with Candace Dodson Reed. She's the chief of staff to Dr. Freeman Hrabowski. And I asked her, this is earlier this morning, I asked her what steps the university had taken to respond to those protests.
First, I want to say that, you know, sexual assault is certainly something that all colleges grapple with, and how to make sure that we're taking care of survivors and also providing proper training and resources for the campus community. And so what happened at UMBC was that we did have the protests, and certainly have had students come forward and talking with us about the challenges that they face on our college campus. One of the things that we initially did was Dr. Hrabowski, when the protest did happen, opened up his office and had conversations with the students and just chose to listen. I think there was a period of time where we said it's important to listen and hear these stories and hear the perspective of the students. And so Dr. Hrabowski did that initially with the protest, and then we held a campus-wide listening session with student partners so that we could understand where their concerns were coming from and really get a pulse of the campus and the community. After that, we have some initial steps that we're taking to start to work on the healing process. But first, it was very important for us to make sure that we were listening to our students.
And Sherry, I also talked to her about what the university can do to change the culture around drinking and, as we're saying, toxic masculinity. This is a little bit of what she had to say about that.
One reoccurring thing that has come up from students is training and education for students when they come into college, and how we enhance that training that they get, and not just training for survivors and young women, but also preventative training for others as well. And so I think that's a big piece of what we'll see. We're going to be working with an outside consultant to look at all of our practices across the board to make sure that we're doing everything that we can to support our students.
I was interested in light of the Kavanaugh allegations, we hear about the culture of prep schools like Georgetown Prep. Jean Marbella wrote a very interesting piece about the prep schools here in the Baltimore area, Gilman and Roland Park and Bryn Mawr and Garrison Forest, et cetera. Is there such a thing as a culture of an institution like a school that really is going to somehow promote or overlook or allow, you know, brutish and in many cases plainly illegal behavior? I mean, Brett Kavanaugh is alleged to have done some terrible things while he was in college. No one thinks of Yale University as a place that, you know, the culture of Yale University is nothing more than some frat boy party school. It's interesting that people use this notion that these institutions are the place where the culture is established and determined. What do you think?
Well, again, this is behavior that's been done in private that hasn't risen to the surface. It's been well known that there's a certain amount of brutishness that happens in highly elite spaces. When my daughter was at Smith, there was a mixer with a neighboring elite private school, Amherst. Kelsey didn't go because she was familiar with a certain amount of brutishness from private school. Her roommate did, about 20 women did. Every one of them came back traumatized because they had been grabbed and rubbed against and pushed at, and every one.
Yeah. But like the institution, what can the institution
looks away
this
often.
Is but this is
but also, I mean, think about it. There are some schools, private boys schools, who are allowing a brutish behavior between men. It's not just directed to women. A certain amount of shoving and pushing and what can only be called violence because it builds strong men. It's not always just looking away. Sometimes it's part of the pedagogy.
Yeah. We'll come back and talk more about it with Dr. Sherry Park. She's the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. We are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page as well. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today, Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Park. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. And she's the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. You can also find us on the WYPR Facebook page. Marion pings us on Facebook and says, "So many Me Too experiences pouring out via social media. I'm heartbroken to find out so many friends have lived this nightmare." Mm. The pervasiveness is really quite extraordinary. I mean, I don't know a professional woman who has not had this happen to her.
And that's part of the awakening. And notice her point is that women are not even telling their friends.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This whole notion about, and this is one of the arguments made, that, you know, Mr. Kavanaugh had these six FBI investigations for other appointments throughout his career, and none of this ever came up. The whole notion of why people don't report. Some two-thirds, it's estimated, two-thirds of assaults on campus remain unreported. There's a whole lot of reasons for it.
Well, and one of them, I mean, we often think, at least in movies, that rape occurs between a woman and a stranger. People are being raped by people they know, and sometimes people that maybe they had hoped to have a relationship with, and it becomes very, very complicated.
Yeah, in most cases, evidently, the perpetrator is somebody you know.
Overwhelmingly.
A lot of times, the reason people give for not reporting is they didn't think it was serious enough. There's a gray area somehow. It just didn't quite, they weren't sure whether or not this was something that rose to the level of assault.
Yeah, and keep in mind, we've been having that cultural conversation. What is rape and when does it become rape? And it's complicated, especially if you're 19.
Let's go to Elizabeth in Baltimore. Elizabeth, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
So I think my question was at this stage when you were talking about the sexual assault on campus and about the kind of atmosphere that a school creates, I guess my question is, like, how complicit is an administration? Like, where is the line? Like, when should they have known, and when do they become enablers? Because speaking anecdotally, it happened to friends of mine where the administration wouldn't want to report rape statistics, so it would be classified as a lesser offense. And there's stories everywhere like this kind of bit about this kind of thing. So I guess my question is, like, when is the administration, like, when is it their turn to step up, and when are they to blame?
Well, that's a really good question, and probably one that they would say that they are stepping up, that they are trying to have more transparency. I guess most administrations. However, obviously, this is bad for business. If you're a president of a college, you don't want to have reports about rapes on your campus. That's the last thing you want. That is not good for admissions.
And unfortunately, and I'm not defending it, you can get caught in having better statistics than your competitor. If you're accurately reporting and they're not, then you get caught. But we have to mention Title IX and the proposed changes, because even colleges and universities who want to police behavior and report may get a bye, if we can call it that, with some of the proposed changes to Title IX. People think of Title IX as women in sports, but that's also the office that handles policy around sexual assault.
And there were directives in the Obama administration that obliged colleges to set up offices of Title IX compliance. And so right. People, when they had an assault, they could go to that office and complain, and they could, the process was codified in this Title IX office.
But they may be decodified with some of the policies that
The Trump administration likely to reverse many of those.
Because they think those policies were too hard on men, young men and boys. So lesser offenses, and she pointed out that sometimes there's a tendency to downgrade to a lesser offense. But the new policy, the proposed policy, would then make it possible not even to report those once they've been downgraded.
Yeah. So, I mean, how a college responds to this, whether it's an office of Title IX or a sexual assault support mechanism of some sort, is clearly difficult. I mean, the woman I spoke to at UMBC this morning says that they've got outside consultants coming in helping them decide what the best way of setting up a mechanism for this is, because you got to feel for them. They don't know necessarily.
And the population is hard. They're over 18. They have privacy rights. And yet there's this special circumstance that makes women very vulnerable.
The notion of toxic masculinity outside of college campuses, certainly, I mean, this extends way past college and high school campuses. There's this group called INCEL. Tell us about them.
Well, INCEL stands for involuntarily celibate. So the idea underneath that is that, and this I think comes out of pornographication, but this is a quote, that sex with women is a God-given right. Now, notice the woman is not part of that equation. It's not something that she agrees to or gives consent, but that they have a right to it. And if they don't get it, then there's an enormous type of misogyny that's just even hard to talk about. But often we don't relate domestic terrorism to a movement. But now there have been two events so far that have been linked to incels who are being violent. This summer, the person who drove his van into a group in Toronto, and then in 2014 in California, were men who were found to have been very active on the incel social media. And so they're so angry that they don't have access to women's bodies that they act out. Now, that idea that the human woman isn't part of the equation shows up in other parts of society. There's sex fantasy research. When women have sex fantasies, and these are general tendencies, they tend to have fantasy about somebody they know or know of. Heterosexual men tend to are much more likely to have fantasies where they don't see the woman's face.
Really?
Yes. Now, I think that this goes back to the alleged crime of Brett Kavanaugh, that, I mean, if he is near blacking out, he may not have focused on her face. Because that idea of, so, you know, we cut women's bodies up in ads all the time so that the face isn't the first thing that men look at. Women look at the eyes, men look at the breast or the behind. I think this phenomenon of, you know, this is leading to another, we did the economics of suffering, and this may be the economics of toxic masculinity show, where there is now market ready sex toys. They're sex dolls. They're life size. They look like human. Now artificial intelligence is part of it. And there's an ABC News show where they interviewed a man who is buying his fifth one now.
These are like sex robots.
Sex robots. Yes. Wow. That is the term. Yeah. And in a way, maybe. I hate to say it's healthy, but it is an outlet for people who don't want somebody with a real brain and a personality. But I think that is the outcome of people being more focused on the sex than the person.
See, what about, you know, people say, oh, she's got such a great smile, or I love her eyes, or something like that.
The robots have those.
Robots have those? Well, good for the robots. But this whole notion of fantasies for men being disassociated with eyes and a smile and a face and a person, that's interesting. But women don't approach it that way.
Yeah. For the most part, no.
Yeah,
no.
Interesting. Stuart in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Parks.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I just wanted to go back to something that Dr. Parks said earlier. In the context of discussing binge drinking on campus, I believe she said that there were some colleges that were now looking to admit more students of color in order to lower their on-campus binge drinking rates. And so I was wondering if she could name, say, two of those colleges that the admissions committee had actually implemented that sort of policy.
Well, first of all, I'm going to back you up, because if you look at the binge drinking rates, I mean, clearly that's well documented in terms of the tendencies towards binge drinking. And as I said, it's starting to unravel with time. But historically and to the present, that's been the case. And unfortunately, no, I'm not going to name the colleges that I know that do that.
But you think that that's one of the, I mean, there are a lot of reasons for admitting more people of color
right
into college. And you think that
that's
plays
a very
into
useful, what they have found is that when that happens.
Is there any reason?
I'm not saying that they say, oh, let's admit this person only because they're
right
not likely to binge drink.
Is there any particular reason that people of color would have less of a proclivity for binge drinking than white people? What is that?
Well, I mean, there are lots of data that students of color don't feel quite as free or safe on campus as white and perhaps more affluent students do. When you're being constantly watched, or you feel that somebody thinks you're less than, you're not likely to act out. And this is not original to me. You're not likely to act out in quite the same way.
Interesting, as always. Well, we shall see you next time, but I appreciate your coming by this time, as always. And first Tuesday of the month, we'll be here. All right. See you, Sherry.
Thanks.
Dr. Sherry Parks, she is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. And as I mentioned, she joins us on the first Tuesday of the month for Midday Culture Connections. That's it for us today. Tomorrow, we're going to discuss Judge Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation process with a panel of legal experts, including Ian Samuel. He's a co-host of First Monday, the podcast about the Supreme Court, and he's a professor of law at Indiana University. Cleta Mitchell is an attorney who specializes in political law. And Thiru Vignaraja, former federal prosecutor who was a law clerk for Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. That's all coming up tomorrow. On Midday, we want to thank Joe's Squared for providing lunch today. Joe's Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. They've got locations and hours at joesquared.com. Here and Now is coming up after a break for news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your listening. Have a great day.